You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
So I'm sitting here with Turney Duff, who wrote the New York Times bestseller, The Buy Side, a Wall Street trader's tale of spectacular success. Turney, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I read your story, and A, you were at the center of the entire hedge fund universe. You made a ton of money. You lost a ton of money. I want you, though, to, without me describing it, define spectacular excess. And then we'll just dive. You know, normally, by the way, I have like a list of questions. Like I prepare for like weeks, all these questions. With you, I didn't kind of come up with questions in advance because the story just tells itself, but then I'll ask you questions during. So what is spectacular excess?
Well, first, just going off of that title, halfway through the writing process, I called my editor at Random House and I said, I'm like, Rick, I want to change the title of the book. He's like, why? What? And as I was writing it, I realized, I'm like, you've got a guy with a waspy name, you know, who grew up in a small town in Maine, who made millions of dollars on Wall Street, and he's a drug addict. So I was like, let's just call it Boo Hoo. Like, that's what I thought, you know, the title should be.
That's interesting because, so you felt like just saying, like 1 year, you have even a chapter, the whole chapter is just your check, $1.8 million that you made that year. What 2003 was the year?
The end of three.
Yeah. So... just saying that, okay, it's almost like we can't cry for you. Or maybe you felt that.
Yeah.
But I didn't get that impression because, A, Wall Street has this way of, like, sucking people in so they spend what they make. And, B, you really had, like, this intense tragedy that anyone could relate to. But we'll get into that.
Sure.
You know, but did you feel, like, guilty sort of saying, like, oh, I made these millions of dollars? And
I think when
before... By the way, you lost it, so...
Yeah, oh, I'm at zero. Before I started writing it, I kind of felt like that. I was like, I'm starting with three strikes. Like, who's going to care? And then about a week before the book was published, I had this overwhelming just fear. I was driving home on the Long Island Expressway, and I'm like, what did I do? Like, did I really just put myself out there like that? But what I chose to do, I said, look, chances are people aren't going to like me after I tell the story. So at no point am I ever, ever, ever going to try to get the reader to like me. I'm not going to try to get you to hate me, but there's going to be nothing in there that is like, you know, got lipstick on it and you know, this is a moment where you're like, you know what, Turney's not such a bad guy. And I figured, you know what, the truth will ultimately prevail, and don't try to get the reader to like you.
Well, so along those lines, and then I'll get back to the spectacular excess in a moment. Did you get mail afterwards from people who hated you or liked you, or what was the reader response that you saw?
Shockingly, the overwhelming response was positive. And one of the biggest lessons I learned from this whole ordeal is, for 40 plus years of my life, I've always done things based on how many friends am I going to gain, how many friends am I going to lose. And it's a calculated decision. And for the first time ever, I said, you know what, I'm just going to do this, and I'm going to let it play out the way it's supposed to. And shockingly, more people leaned towards liking me than didn't. And what I learned was, I would rather have you not like me versus you like me because I only show you part of myself or my good self.
It reminds me of how so many people say, and I'm forgetting now the exact quote and writer, but basically the idea that writing is a form of psychic surgery where you kind of dive deep into yourself regardless of the audience, and when you take that viewpoint, you sort of cure something in yourself. So you maybe you're... biggest infliction, and you even see this, or affliction, and you even see this in the book, is you're always thinking of, how do I get people to like me as opposed to not like me? And do you think the process of writing this book and putting it out there somewhat cured that insecurity in you?
It definitely helped. You know, it's a daily thing for me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't just cure itself and I'm, you know, off, you know, to do my thing. Awareness is huge in my life. And so I'm much more aware that is one of my character defects. I want people to like me. And now that I'm aware of that, I'm able to sort of navigate my own, you know, sort of path where maybe not so much importance is put on whether you like me or not. Because you know what? When I walk out of here, I have no idea. You might be like, Turney was the worst guest ever, so boring and so full of himself.
I don't think so, but go ahead.
It's possible, right? But I'm not going to know. And if I sit here and try to give you some great interview so James likes me, it's not going to be as good of an interview as if I'm just honest and tell you how I feel and who I am. And at the end of the day, hopefully you like me. If you don't, I'm sorry, you know?
Well, so on that note then, what is excess? And define it in terms of your stories that happened to you.
Sure.
So you made that $1.8 million, you made, you know, good checks every year during this period, and you were living large, but in such an extreme way that it essentially kind of just, you know, greatly affected to the negative what happened
right.
to you. So what was going on?
So, I mean, this started, you know, probably at birth. I was always trying to outdo myself. So if my sixth birthday, you know, I had 10 kids there. Well, I wanted 12 kids in a goat, you know, for the seventh birthday. So I was probably my biggest sort of own rival. And I constantly was trying to outdo the night before or, you know, any accomplishment that I received or got. Felt great, but it was an instant, you know, like it was just a fleeting moment. And so I've been sober for 6+ years now.
Sober.
And, yeah, sober. Mm-hmm. Drugs, alcohol, nothing. But very often you talk about people who struggle with addiction and there's this feeling that people get, and I'm sure everyone gets this, but that moment when you feel like I have arrived, okay? I was addicted to that feeling, you know, like something would happen, let's say in a New York City nightlife scene where, you know, I was recognized or I was treated a certain way and I felt like I had arrived, that was only good for that night. And I wanted to arrive the next night. And so the excess was really, it was a combination of, you know, obviously money and the way that I spent money and women and power and just I have the disease of more. I want more. James, if we filled the studio right now with cocaine, right?
And I now we're talking.
In, yes. And I walked in here in 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever. And this entire room was filled with cocaine. I'd look at it and I'd be like, it's not enough. You know, it's not enough.
Wait, I don't understand. So you would be able to consume that amount or you would give it out? Or
everything. But I'm just saying nothing was enough. So you could invite me over to your apartment and show me, you know, $25,000 worth of blow and it would look glorious and I'd be like, this is amazing. But there'd be a small little voice in my head and be like, it's not enough. It's not quite enough.
Well, during this time, did you ever feel like, okay, like when you made that first seven-figure bonus or whatever, did you ever feel like, okay, this is enough or even for a moment?
What's interesting about that is, so let's backtrack to 1994. I'm at Morgan Stanley. I'm in private wealth client services and I'm living on 85th in Columbus. I'm the third guy in a two-bedroom apartment. I'm sleeping on a couch. Some Thursdays, I'm borrowing money for a Subway token just to get to work. And I said to my friends, I'm like, you know, if I could just make $50,000 a year, all of my problems would be solved. All of them. And fast forward, you know, 8 years later, I make $2 million. And in my head, I'm saying, if I could just make $3 million a year, all of my problems would be solved.
You know, I had a similar experience around 2000 where it was like the internet bubble and I had sold a company and I had made a good amount of money, but I had the same problem. I figured this is not, even though it was enough to live the rest of my life, I had this crazy, insane thought, if I can't make $100 million, I'm poor.
Right.
And so this is where the boo-hoo kind of comes in. Like, no one's gonna forgive you this feeling. But at the same time, it was that feeling was the sole reason I lost every dime I had. Because in order to achieve that amount, in order to always achieve more, you have to risk. And you have to risk what you have, whether it's some aspect of your personality or money or whatever, or your relationships. And so those risks, I wasn't prepared to take, even though I thought I was, and I lost everything. So I imagine when you're constantly seeking more, as opposed to focusing on doing what you love or whatever, the risks are too great.
Well, 100%. And, you know, people used to, you know, whether they would look at me as an employee or friends or, you know, because I used to have numerous things going on and people would be like, wow, Tony's so driven, you know, because I'd be the first guy in the office, no matter how hungover I was, you know, and I was constantly working, whether I was working the room or, you know, working the club or I was constantly working and people would say, wow, Tony is so driven. Now that I can reflect back, I wasn't driven. It was discontent. I needed more. And
what do you think you were self-medicating against with that feeling? Like, what? Where did the insecurity come from?
I'm sure there's, you know, plenty of stuff in my childhood. You know, I've always kind of had this nobody loves me syndrome. You know, maybe it's my birth sign. You know, I've got a lot of Jupiter in my chart, but I had this fear of ordinary, fear of being normal. If let's say you and I went skiing, and this makes no sense, right? But
going skiing makes no sense to begin with.
So you and I are skiing, right? And for some reason, I would rather either be the worst skier or the best skier. I don't want to be, you know, the middle. You know what I mean? Like, because you're talking about the worst skier and you're talking about the best skier, but you're not talking about, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5. So there was always this feeling of, a lot of it's based on insecurity and just this, you know, I wanted to be loved. I wanted to be adored. I wanted people to like me. You know, it all goes back to that. But I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. Because I wanna reel it back just to kind of say where you were. So you were at the Galleon Hedge Fund, which is I never know how to say his last name, Raj.
Rajaratnam.
Yeah, and he was the big insider trading scandal. Like he kind of started the whole kind of like let's go for all the hedge fund guys and insider. He was the huge inside trader.
Yes.
Then you worked at Argus, which is a healthcare hedge fund, and this is where you made your first million.
Yep.
Or at least in a year.
Yep.
Then you worked at Berkowitz.
In between there was a rehab, but yes.
Rehab, then Kramer, then not Kramer Berkowitz, but it became
JL Berkowitz.
It used to be Jim Cramer's hedge fund, but then Jeff Berkowitz bought it, and you worked at Berkowitz.
Yep.
So I feel like you were sort of at the center of the entire hedge fund world, and you were a trader for them. So you weren't an analyst. You weren't picking the stocks necessarily.
No.
Although there was overlap, you were trading. And from reading, and then I want to get to the kind of what happened to you in a second, but I'm also fascinated by the trading aspect. Because it seemed to me from your descriptions that a lot of the returns of that your hedge funds were generating were based on kind of tricks and little schemes almost that you were doing as a trader.
Right.
And while I don't want to focus too much on that, it seemed like in some cases maybe the bulk of the returns were coming from like ways you were kind of manipulating the system a little bit in your trading, and in part because of the size you were trading. So what were some of the tricks there?
Trading
like tens of millions of dollars a day.
I mean, are you talking more like tricks in the market, like whether it be insider trading or just kind of...
No, tricks in the market that were not the illegal, although it was all kind of gray area, so...
Right. I mean, this isn't really a trick, but like, you know, one thing that I did that I don't think most traders did, I was very aware of everyone in the office, and I was aware of their tendencies, and so I would have a biotech analyst who was phenomenal, right? She was great. She had good information. She knew what she was talking about. And when she would run up to my desk and panic and say, "Hey, Turney, Biogen's down another $2, like we got to sell." I would say, "Well, has anything changed?" And she'd be like, "No, but you know, it keeps going down. We got to sell." And so as soon as she would walk away, I would buy more because I knew her tolerance for pain was, you know, a buy signal. And so I start rather than like sitting there doing fundamental research or, you know, reading reports or you know, doing a doctor call or whatever, I was kind of just being aware of everyone around me. And
it's almost like you were trading the minds of the people sitting around you.
I was, mm-hmm. because people make the same mistakes over and over again. We had a guy at Argus who, you know, in my mind was absolute gold. He was awesome. And one day my PM comes to me and he's like, you know, we got to fire him. I was like, are you kidding me? I'm like, this guy is 100% wrong. He's always wrong. I mean, if you're 100%, I don't care which way, wrong or right, that's gold, right? So so I would bet against him every time he had an idea or wanted to add or wanted to, you know, subtract.
Did he know you were betting against him? Like, could he tell from the...
I mean, sometimes, I mean...
He must have known as all his picks were wrong.
The positions don't lie, but, you know, I was making money. Yeah. You know what I mean?
And how much did your bosses know you were doing that so you would get the credit for these kind of enhanced returns on the trading?
Yes. For a number of years, I was kind of, I don't know how you say it, I guess sort of the golden boy in some ways. And then, you know, obviously when the drugs and alcohol started to take over, I sort of lost that title. But
why? Because the drugs and alcohol were obviously they were infecting your night, but were they infecting the day enough that your trading was off and you could no longer get those enhanced returns?
I was making dumb mistakes and I wasn't working as hard. I was calling in sick, and I mean it was a nightmare. But like you were talking about like another trick. So recently in the news, there's been some talk of spoofing. Are you? It's basically putting fake orders into the market. I used to do that shit all the time. Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah. Okay. This is a pro swearing podcast.
All right, excellent. I'm not a big swearer, but occasionally it slips out. You know, the specialists on the floor used to be like, you know, licensed crooks, right? And I hated trading with a specialist. And sometimes I would get a phone call from like the guy at Prudential who said, "Hey, Turney, I'm long 100,000 shares of XYZ. The specialist knows it, and he's basically putting the metal down and squeezing me, and he's gonna force me out of my position." I was like, "All right, watch this." And so I go and I put on my dot machine, which just goes directly to the floor, and about a quarter, you know, maybe 25 cents below the market, I put in an order to buy 500,000 shares. just to spook the hell out of him. And so the specialist freaks out because now he thinks there's this monster buy order. Stock rips up. My guy Prudential can sell his shares. And then all of a sudden I cancel my order. But I was just like,
you know, you did that in a I noticed one trade you did. You did that in a particularly evil way in one situation where it was the and there's a lot of like illegal things happening in this trade. None that you did, although maybe the spoofing is
sure,
a great area.
I'm sure I was definitely doing illegal
things. But the broker, the woman that you were using as a broker, mm-hmm. and the marking up at the end of the year, the trades. But describe that trade because it's. There was at least two things that were totally illegal in there, and it was fascinating how hedge funds kind of scam their customers a little bit.
I'll try to make it as simple as possible. But so the only time a hedge fund makes profit is on a realized profit or realized loss. Like that's how it is determined how they get paid at the end of the year. And the only day of the year where that is not the case is on December 31st or the last day of trading. And they use the market price of that position. And so on the last day of the year, it was very common for me to...
And many hedge funds.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe I was leading the way, but you know, there was plenty of people doing the same thing. And so if I could get one of our positions up, you know, let's say a few dollars, at the end of the year, they're going to use that price to determine our profits. And so let's say, for instance, we had a stock, Cyberonics, CYBX, very illiquid, maybe trades 100,000 shares a day, and we have 5 million shares, right? So at 3:45 on the last day of the year, I run out and I buy as many shares as I can and I just try to rip that stock.
Right. So whether or not it was a good investment at that point,
I didn't care.
It could go down on January 1st. But if you, let's say you have 5 million shares and you buy a stock that trades 100,000 shares a day and you buy 300,000 shares just in the last 15 minutes, it's going to go up $5 maybe.
Yep.
So you have 25 million in gains from just those 15 minutes. Even though it's not realized and you'll never be able to get out, you could make the hedge fund, which takes 20% of the profits, is going to make $5 million because of those 15 minutes.
Exactly.
Just on paper gains.
Yes. Yeah. And so that was very common. And it got harder to do as the years went on because either people kind of clued in or what. But so on this one particular year, I set up to do this and I called this woman and I said, look, you know, buy these five stocks and short these five and, you know, do as much as you can to, you know, rip them. Like just rip the stocks in the direction I want them to go. And I watched the stocks about 10 minutes before I told her to get to work and they started to move. And
so that so now we're on the second illegal activity. So the first one is ripping the stocks for artificial gains so the hedge fund managers can basically take money from their investors. That's illegal. Second thing is what she did.
She leaked my orders to someone else.
Which is illegal. Front running is illegal.
Right. Yeah, right. And her client was benefiting. And so the stocks didn't go as high or as low as I wanted to on that year because they were met with some demand at the very end of the day, because whoever was the front runner was selling them back to me. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I took note. I was like, okay. I'm like, she screwed me. And I kind of had this attitude, you know, it was like, you know, if you're going to fuck me, I'm going to fuck you harder. And I didn't say anything. I let a year go by. And the following year, I called the same woman at 3:30 p.m. and I said, hey, I've got a bunch of these orders that, you know, you know what I want to do, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod. And she's like, yeah, definitely. Great. Okay. Gave her the list of, you know, million share orders, gave her about 10 stocks, all somewhere between 500,000 and a million shares that I was going to either rip up or
all
rip
on like small, pretty much
very
illiquid
stocks, names.
So that any movement and any big buy at all, particularly on like New Year's Eve day,
basically,
is going to move the stock up.
The two boxes that needed to be checked were they a significant position that we had on our books? Because that's the only reason I would want to move those stocks. And were they illiquid? Mm-hmm. Could I move them? Because I couldn't move Microsoft if I wanted. You know. And so, you know, here we are a year later, and I give her these orders. And I say, you know, specifically, I'm like, do not start these till 350. Do not start these till 350. And, you know, I waited till 349. And then I called, and all the stocks started to move at like 3:40, right? Mm. And so I called the woman and I was like, oh, actually, I need to cancel all those orders. Yeah, we're not going to do it this year. And she was like, oh. Like, I could hear her choking on a pen cap.
Because she had already told everybody else. She front, and they were like,
right,
they were waiting for you to move in so they can get out, you know.
And so then once I hung up with her and, you know, she probably thought she was going to be fired or her clients were going to hate her, I called another guy and did the opposite of what I told her. So not only was I moving the stocks where I wanted them to go, I had these other people.
You were just crushing.
Who were panicking because they had 5 minutes of the rest of the year, and now they're going to be stuck with like a big loss. So
essentially, I'm wondering if there's a third illegal thing in there, any kind of like manipulating of the knowledge you had about how she was playing you. But that's probably fair game.
Yeah.
So
I think so.
And were your bosses aware? Like you had a huge gain that year at the last 15 minutes of the year. Also, like were your bosses aware of you kind of, you know, just to give you credit, like were they aware of the money you were making them?
Yes. I mean, did they come over and put a gold star on my desk? No, but they were fully aware of, I mean, how can you not be?
Right, because they had this huge game that day.
Right.
Probably outsized compared to other days.
Right.
So when did it start to kind of verge into, and you described many tricks in the trading that you were doing that I thought were very interesting and kind of used to enhance hedge fund returns game, mostly legal tricks. But then, the first question is, how much of kind of hedge fund activity, even now, would you view as gray area to illegal? Because I even see in my own circle stuff that I would question, like, oh, this doesn't seem quite correct.
Right. It's tough because I think the business has gotten a lot cleaner since Raj. And, you know, the more and more we would see perp walks or read bad headlines, there became a lot more fear. But what's interesting now is it seems like they're narrowing the definition of insider trading, which I think is a mistake. Because if I know the rules, then I know how to cheat, right? Or I know how to sort of circumvent or loophole. And so as they narrow the definition of insider trading, I think it's potential for it to get worse. But over the last, let's say, 5 to 6, 7 years, it's been so ambiguous. And there's been fear of, we can't do that because, what if that's, you know, I don't want to go to jail.
But there are even like websites though, and there were more admittedly earlier, but there are even websites that say, you know, like whispers of rumors, like, oh, we hear such and such company is going to blow out earnings. Well, how did they hear? They must either people are talking or if they're accurate, you know, and some of these websites are fairly accurate.
Right. I believe the definition is you need to, there's two things. You need to know that the information is actually, you know, insider, and the tippee is supposed to be, you know, if he's rewarded, you know, for his information. It's hard to check those two boxes.
Right, because that's pretty extreme. So let's say you just happen to, like, I don't know, peek over the CFO of a company in the subway or whatever, and he's looking at his numbers, and you know this is good. Is that insider trading then? Because you didn't pay the CFO,
right? I think under the definition it isn't, which is it's a little crazy. But like back in the day, you know, I knew what was going to be on the cover of Barron's every Thursday. I knew, you know what I mean, and there was usually a trade there, right? I would have a guy, you know, trading at.
How would you know?
Because I had a guy who had a friend who worked at Barron's, and we would be told what was on the cover, you know.
And would that guy get paid, the Barron's guy?
Not through me, you know.
Right. So then it was just, oh, this is just a rumor basically circulating around.
Yes, but I knew inherently that, like, this isn't right.
Right.
But that's how the game was played. I would also have, I would have a guy at a program desk, right? And I'd get a phone call and be like, Turney, we're putting $1 billion, you know, into the market at 3 o'clock. Click. So I know how to, you know, sort of set my chess pieces up to, you know, if I'm buying stocks and I'm going to go early, if I'm going to sell, I'm going to wait till, you know, till 3:30. Like, so I don't know. Is that a direct? Yeah, that's information. Yeah, that's insider trading, you know.
So just theoretically, do you think better to have like information like that more accurately reflect, like having that information in the market as opposed to just between friends talking on the phone. Like when once you started buying before 3 o'clock in that last situation, you're actually reflecting, you're actually putting more information into the market, which is better maybe for the small investor. Better for them to know, oh, something's going on, so I'm going to buy too. Right. Rather than suddenly at 3 o'clock, this massive $1 billion comes in. So it seems like insider trading, I'm just playing the devil's advocate. Yeah. I don't have like an opinion on it one way or the other, but it seems like that creates greater efficiency in the market.
I would agree. And the other thing that I would say is, and I get it, like some people want to say it's a victimless crime, which isn't completely accurate, but let's say I know a company's being, you know, taken out, right? And you don't. And you already have your sell order out there in the market. James wants to sell 100,000 shares at $50. I scoop it up, right? So I am the beneficiary of the inside information. But guess what? You already had that. I didn't put a gun to your head. Right. You were selling that stock whether I was buying it or not.
Well, let's take the Raj example that really did him in, which if I remember correctly, it was the buyout of Hilton. So and that might have just been one of many, but that's the trade I remember that he did. That well, was
don't forget the Gupta trade with Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, but yeah.
Buffett okay. putting in $5 billion.
Yeah, that's
he
a big
got
one.
That call at 355. Yeah.
So but let's say a stock's going to go from 145 to 150 in one sharp jump because he knows something. As opposed to if lots of people are trading on insider information because it's legal, say, it'll start to go up more smoothly. So maybe the guy who has the sell order in it, you know, in the middle there, he's like, oh, what's going on here? As opposed to one sharp jump where he's taken out, it's going up smoothly. He has more options to pull out his sell order.
Right.
So maybe if it's totally efficient and the inside information, like now lawyers and investors and accountants and everybody who knows the information starts trading on it, that might reflect a more accurately moving market. So as the stock gets closer and closer to being acquired, the stock is more correctly reflecting right. the odds that this is going to get acquired
yeah.
at a certain price.
No, you're 100% right. I mean, I don't know the solution. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it would be hard for me to say, yes, insider trading should be legal because obviously there would be other issues. Yes, the market might be more efficient, but, you don't want people on street corners handing envelopes of bags of money and you know and side deals and
but there wouldn't it would just like if drugs were legal suddenly the price of drugs would like illegal drugs would go down because it would be again a more efficient market. So information itself is a market, and if everybody was acting on information, then information would get cheaper. It wouldn't be like bags of money. It would be like, oh, my cousin's a lawyer on this deal. He says it's going to happen. Go trade on it. So suddenly right. information would go down to free.
Right. No, you're right. You're right.
I'm just pretending. Like, I don't really know. But
although I do think drugs should be legal.
I totally do as well. So, because look at, again, just how much crime is ancillary 100%. To the drug trade, you know, but like, you know, murder, muggings, you know, all sorts of crimes because drug prices are inflated because it's done in all these, you know, by basically, you know, criminals, it becomes part of their business right. to trade drugs as opposed to legal institutions.
Right. And that's kind of my theory also, because like, I believe I'm like, it's time to make new mistakes. We've been making the same.
I like
same,
that quote.
Thank you. We've been making the same mistakes for the last 30 years. Let's make some new ones. You know what I mean? I don't know what's going to happen if we legalize drugs. But at least let's say heroin's legal, right? You know, that's one of the harsher drugs out there. If it's legal, you can at least now have a dialogue with the person who's standing in line. You and I aren't going to stand in that line, right? You know, I'm sober and I'm assuming you don't do heroin.
I have heard it's a pretty impressive drug. I don't do it.
Just because it's legal doesn't mean I'm going to start doing heroin, right? But at least now you can have a dialogue with the people who are standing in that line, whereas now there's no dialogue.
So let's get into that. So you were having these great years as a trader. You were achieving some level of satisfaction with yourself and your work, but you now we get into what you were saying earlier, this feeling of more, and you couldn't get it enough from work, so drugs became a bigger and bigger part of your life. Like, you mentioned cocaine. What were just all the drugs you were taking? What's the full list?
there was a night I was out and these guys were doing something under the table, and
the first place to look for illegal drugs.
Right. There was some exchange going on, right? And I could sniff that out a mile away. And so they're doing something illegal. And I remember vividly saying, I want one. And they're like, oh, okay. And they hand me a pill and I take it. And then I'm like, what is it? And now that I can reflect back, I'm like, who does that? Like, right. That's illegal. That's a drug, whatever. I want it. And then you ask after you take it. Like, so, I wasn't opposed to anything. Cocaine was clearly my go-to and my favorite, but you know, whether it was ecstasy and, you know, smoking weed and obviously alcohol, Vicodin, you know, Percocet, you know, whatever I could get my hands on.
So with cocaine, you said that is your favorite. What I have to be honest, I've never tried cocaine, and I'm just totally stupid. So what's the benefit? Like, what did you feel on cocaine?
So I'll just back up a little bit. The first time it was offered, I was kind of a late bloomer with cocaine. It didn't really enter into my life until like right around age 30 or so. But the first time it was offered, the first, and I talked a little bit about this in the book, the first thought I had was Len Bias, you know, because I'm a kid of the 80s, 1986 or 85, whatever it was, you know, the night before he was drafted, the day after he was drafted, he tried cocaine once and died. So in my head, it was, for the last 15 years, you do cocaine, you die. And so I didn't do it the first time it was offered. Fast forward 6 months later, my bank account had changed. The people that I was running around with had changed. I was kind of living this more sort of luxurious, opulent New York City life, and it just didn't seem so menacing. And so I did cocaine for the first time, and it was so good that from my way from the bathroom back up to the rooftop, I was at the Thompson Hotel, I had this moment where I said, this is going to be a problem. Like, it's too good. I'll worry about that later, but this is going to be a problem. And the best way I can describe it is I felt like I'd been hibernating for the last 20 years, and I was finally awake, and every sense was heightened. I felt things. I smelled things. I could see the entire room, and that first cocaine high, just it made me feel invincible. And for someone who has got so much shit going on inside of them, whether he's insecure or doesn't think people loves him, you know, it filled every single hole within my soul. So like, I don't know, I'm just making something up, but if you could take like one of those sort of ultra ray images of my soul, like there would be all of these empty pockets, right? But when I did cocaine, it was entirely filled.
And so just on the surface, like let's say that was like a pharmaceutical medicine, that sounds like, oh my God, that sounds great. So where is the problem? And so, I'm just again being totally naive.
Of course, of course. It felt so good, I wanted it again.
Well, because how long does the high last?
You know, early on, it lasts longer, and it kind of gets shorter and shorter and shorter. You know, in my early days, three or four of us guys could go out with $100 bag, and it would sort of supplement the drinking, and I could do a few bumps in the bathroom and be good for a few hours. And slowly, it got to the point where we all needed our own $100 bag. And then it got to the point where we were meeting the dealer and we weren't even going out and we were just doing our bags. And then it got to the point where we were just all meeting our dealers individually and staying home and just doing blow.
So that would be, so the focus became not having a fun time with your friends, but just getting the experience of filling these holes in the soul.
Yeah. And
you had to do it like all day, because then I imagine the high would go down to like a half hour.
Your tolerance would get bigger and bigger. Yeah. And it got to the point where it was pretty brutal. Like, there were a number of years where I was sleeping, you know, probably four nights a week. And that's not good sleep, but there were three days a week where I was not going to bed. Another interesting thing about cocaine, so the receptor in the brain where I guess you get the sort of cocaine high is literally next door to the same sort of receptor for sex. And for me, it was this giant cocktail of, you know, cocaine, alcohol, sex, pornography, whatever it is. And so you know, near the end, if I had an urge for sex, that meant I had an urge for cocaine. And getting sober was difficult because I had to unwind all of these, you know, sort of.
Is it possible to unwind it? Like when the brain gets eventually, so messed up like that?
Yeah, but it took some time and some rewiring and, you know, it was not easy.
Is there what about coming down off of like a high like that? Do you go too far in the other direction? Like, do the holes get bigger?
Yes, 100%. And there is so much guilt and shame that you carry for whether you lied to your girlfriend or your husband or your wife or maybe you called an escort or, you know, maybe you stole money from someone. Whatever you did, you know, to get that high. And while you were high, when you come down, you're carrying all of the shit that you were carrying before. So, like, you know, we talk about it sometimes, like within sobriety groups or whatnot. But it's like, if whatever you're dealing with, you're not going to improve it with, you know, a drink or a drug. Yes, it temporarily, you know, sort of relieves it. But when you come down, it's just as bad, if not worse. So for me, it became this vicious cycle.
And you know, during this time, you got married, you had a child.
We never officially married.
Okay. So you had a long-term relationship
we were partners.
Right. And Jen in the book,
yep.
I don't know if that's her real name, but
yep,
I guess
it is.
And Lola's your daughter.
Yep.
So, you had a kid during this time.
Yep.
And they, for a while or at least Jen was unaware that you were, taking drugs. Like in the book, you mentioned you would go to hotel rooms and rent hotel rooms. Why would you go to a hotel room as opposed to like a club or whatever?
Because there's huge amounts of paranoia. I didn't want to cheat on Jen, but I wanted to watch pornography. So a hotel room was great. And I could be alone. And, you know, when I would do cocaine, the best high was that phone call I would make to my girlfriend. This is when she was out on Long Island, but when I was in the city, it was a little different. But when I was able to make a phone call and say, I'm staying in the city, I'm not coming home tonight, but I'll be home tomorrow, whatever. And I'm looking at a mound of cocaine and I've got the remote control and I'm about to order 24 hours of porn. Hanging up the phone was this euphoric feeling of like, I'm gonna get away with it. And the first line, first cigarette, first drink, phenomenal 15 minutes. And then the next
15 minutes.
Yeah. The next 12 hours were absolute hell.
What was the hellish part? Like the coming down or the constantly refilling or not sleeping? Or...
all of it, but like this is no exaggeration. I would be in a hotel room and you see it like in movies and TV all the time, but like no lie, I would check the peephole hundreds of times. Because I would think that someone was out in the hallway.
About to bust in.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, you know, as many coke addicts can probably attest to, you're walking down Fifth Avenue and you got a $100 bag in your pocket. You're thinking FBI, you're thinking DEA, you're thinking NYPD. Like, you're thinking that New York City law enforcement is focused on your $100 bag, which is ludicrous, right? But that's where your brain is going. And at least for me, and I don't want to get too off track, but for my and I actually
this is on track, by the way. But, okay. But go ahead.
Well, I didn't talk about this in the book because I didn't want to scare people. But a huge element of my addiction and my own sort of destruction was I used to see shit like and hear things and. And I would sit in my bedroom for, you know, 6 hours watching a tiny black dot slowly move under the door or like, you know, a shadow. And so the hallucinations and the paranoia were 100% real for me. And I talk a little bit about it in terms of the book with I fully believed that I was being followed for a number of years.
Well, let me ask you, because you mentioned this in the book, and I almost didn't know if it was unresolved or paranoia or what. But like, for instance, you talk about a white-haired guy who you saw yep. several times who you felt was following you. Was that person really following you? Like, were you ever... I couldn't tell. Was the FBI or SEC after you for stock stuff or drug stuff? Like, was it real? You didn't come, not in a bad way, but you didn't go full circle on that for right. some reason. So I'm just curious.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think partly because I still don't know, right? The people that I saw on the street, like that gentleman or other people, 100% real. Like I wasn't like imagining like purple elephants floating in, you know, in well, some days I was, but that's a different story. But it was real, you know? Do I know that they were following me for whether it was some of the shenanigans I was pulling on, you know, the last day of the year or insider trading? And I have a connection to a guy, David Slain, who was considered a dream informant and helped bring down 37 people. He was my first boss at Galleon. And who knows what was going on with
so
him.
Once you heard that David was an informant, did you like freak out? Like, am I next on the list? And they're just crossing the names off one at a time.
I knew that like my name is clearly had been, I don't know about highlighted, but probably circled and maybe starred.
Have you ever done a Freedom of Information Act thing where you get their files on you?
No, should I?
Yeah, maybe just to see for book two.
Right. All my friends, and this isn't even funny because sobriety is a serious thing. But I've got a group of these guy friends who, great friends, they don't do drugs, but they still drink. But they always joke around. They're like, dude, you got a relapse. Like, the buy side too. And I'm like, it's not funny. But, so, sorry.
No, but, you know, as a writer, do you ever think like, oh my gosh, that was my story, and now what am I going to do for a story? Like, I don't have content. Like, content was making millions and snorting as many yep. drugs as possible and ruining my relationship with girlfriend and child all at the same time.
Yeah.
So that's content for a book. And do you ever get a little bit anxious? You know, this book's out. It's been out a while. Do you ever get anxious? What am I going to do next for content?
100%. And I think that's sort of typical for a writer, whether you're as prolific as Stephen King or, you know, a one-hit wonder. I think a lot of writers kind of feel that regardless of their own situation. You know, I was a ghostwriter on a book that recently came out. It's doing well. I'm in negotiations to write a memoir for someone else, a significant person. And if it goes through, it would be a great coup for me. So yes, am I concerned? Do I have another memoir within me? Maybe, I don't know. A lot of people who've read The Buy Side want me to write another, you know, sort of Wall Street type book. It's just it hasn't come out of me. You know, my literary agent from day one is like, I want you to be the next Michael Lewis. And I'm like, there's only one Michael Lewis, right? So like,
well, but the good point there is Michael Lewis got into like his first book, which propelled him to the stratosphere, was Liar's right. Poker about Wall Street. But then he kind of did more the way he reinvented himself and his writing was he embedded himself in kind of all of these high stakes situations right. and then wrote about it. So for instance, Moneyball was a classic where he wasn't obviously a baseball coach, but by getting into this whole kind of area of how baseball coaching was changing using
right.
quantitative information, it became like this fascinating informative book, but also a story of like, you know, rags to riches in the baseball league.
Right. Yeah. And you know, his work has been amazing, and he's uncovered some great stories. And you know, like a guy like Ben Mezrich, right? He's written a bunch of, you know, sort of stories that the public cares about, and he's able to kind of sort of emerge himself into those worlds and those stories. And
whereas I think like in the 21, I forget the original name of the
bringing
book.
Down the house.
Yeah, he more became part of the story later on. I think he embedded himself more in the story, like the right. oligarchs one.
Right.
And he's been on my podcast too. Very good writer.
Yeah.
So have you ever thought about doing that, like kind of finding a high stakes situation similar to what you've been in, and instead of experiencing it, more embedded yourself into it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think if I were to kind of find something that I'm comfortable with. You know, maybe it's more along the lines of Ben Mezrich, where it's, you know, rich boys behaving badly. Obviously, I know a lot about, you know, kind of getting sober, and I also know a lot about, you know, networking or being social, and you know, like we talked about earlier, like there was a time in a period where, you know, I wasn't the darling of New York City, but there wasn't anything I couldn't do in New York City,
right? Because it seemed like once you started, as you mentioned, living this opulent lifestyle, it also became part of your business, because that's how you would make connections, that's how you would make the people in your network happy, so that they would then return the favor, perhaps in a work setting. So you went totally in the party scene, where perhaps you were kind of handing out the drugs or getting people into clubs or whatever, and then they would return the favor in various ways.
100%. And can I tell you a short anecdote? Yeah. And this plays very big into sort of my addiction and who I am and who I was. In the book, I talk about this birthday party that I kind of threw for myself. Had Naughty by Nature perform.
How'd you get Naughty by Nature to perform, by the way? Like, Tretch is like my favorite rapper.
He's great. Right after September 11th, I partnered with a friend of mine. His name's Jesse Itzler. He's a rapper in the 90s. His rap name was Jesse James. He had all these connections. He was managing Run DMC. I reached out to him. The first party, I got Rob Bass, PM Dawn, Dougie Fresh.
Oh, my God.
And so I just started throwing these kind of old-school hip-hop parties. But so at my 34th birthday party, I had flown in all of these guys from Ohio that I went to college with, and I'm standing there, and at the end of the night, they're like, Turney, come here. So I walk over, and they're like, who are you? And I'm like, what? They're like, seriously, they're like, who are you? And I didn't know what they were getting at, and they said, we've been standing at the bar all night, and we've been meeting people, and they've been coming up to us saying, wait, oh, you know Turney? Can you introduce me to Turney? Or other people would be like, wait, can you just point him out? I want to see what Turney looks like. And when they told me this, it was like crack cocaine. It filled all of those holes. And I felt like I had arrived. And it just as quickly evaporated. But, like, that's what I was trying to build. It was like Turney, you know what I mean, and I'm embarrassed now, but you know, I wanted to be known, and I wanted to be known on the New York City sort of social nightlife scene.
And so reeling forward, obviously you never got in trouble apparently for any kind of, you know, even though you were with all these funds that, you know, tons of people got in trouble, you sort of passed that by, but you didn't pass by the drug thing, and eventually it took its toll. I guess you left Wall Street, and we were talking earlier, you said you haven't been on Wall Street since 2009 in terms of working for a hedge fund.
Right, right.
And that also coincides with when you went totally sober. So, like, how linked is the sobriety, or how linked was the drug use to the hedge fund use?
Well, I'd been asked before if I thought Wall Street, you know, made me a drug addict, and I 100% say no. Did it enable me? Of course, you know, money kept me out, like, you know, the lifestyle, and, you know, a big part of why I was successful on Wall Street was because of the entertaining, being able to get information and get guys to help me. And that was by being out. So, you know, when I stripped that all away, you know, I was kind of just left with buy and sell tickets and, you know, charts. And I was just like, this is beat, right? When I got back from rehab the first time, I didn't think there was a solution. I had a mortgage. I had a girlfriend. I had a daughter. I had certain expenses. I needed to live a certain way. And so when I got back from rehab the first time, there was no other option. I had to go back to Wall Street. And then the second time around, I'd just been so beaten and so just kind of left for dead that I knew if I went back, it was gonna be just for the money. And I don't know where I got the courage, but I said, I was like, it's not worth it, you know? And I don't wanna be overly dramatic, but I should be dead, right? I'm on borrowed time. And you know, if I picked up tomorrow, it would not be pretty. So, you know, I just decided that for the first time in a long time. And sorry for backtracking a little bit.
No, that's okay.
I became successful on the trading desk because I had great instincts and I used my gut. And along the way, I kind of lost that, and the drugs and the alcohol and the booze and the hookers and all of that sort of clouded my judgment. And so now here I am, I don't know, 60 days sober, have a job.
6 years sober. Oh, no. You're saying
this
back
is,
then.
Yeah, end of 2009, beginning of 2010. I have like 60 days sober, and I'm getting a job offer from a huge hedge fund called Pioneer Path. And I just knew it wasn't right, you know. And I probably could have made seven figures, and I was like, you know what, I've relied on my gut and my instincts, and that actually helped me, you know, sort of succeed. And my gut and my instinct is saying, do not go back to Wall Street.
Wow, that's hard to turn down, you know, particularly with a kid and everything. It's hard to turn down where you thought you could make seven figures a year for the next 20 years or whatever. But how does somebody build up a gut like that? Because I think most people would say, okay, I'm going to do this for 5 years, even though I know it's bad for me, and then we'll see. Like, how do you build up your gut?
You know, I might have also benefited a little bit from, I just turned 40, and for, you know, it's as arbitrary as, you know, 32, right? But in my mind, like, 40 was kind of this, like, midpoint. And I don't know. I think getting sober and getting honest really, really sort of helped me and allowed me to get the courage. And I had something inside of me that I describe as like only a mother could understand. I knew that if I stayed sober and if I became the best father I could be, that everything would work out. Maybe I got lucky. I don't know. But
Okay. So let's talk about it since then. Has it worked out?
I'll tell you this. So I'm living in the middle of Long Island, which is, you know, not my first choice. I'm paying rent. I'm in a, you know, the first floor level of a split level house. I'm paying $1,300 a month in rent. I'm driving a busted up Honda Civic Hybrid. I see my daughter 5 or 6 times a week. I try to get a little bit of writing done every day, and I've never been happier. And 10 years ago, I'm living, you know, in a 3,000 square foot apartment in Tribeca, going out every night, millions of dollars in the bank. So the fact that I've never been this happy tells me, yes, it's worked out.
Well, that's great. I mean, I think it's a very inspirational story. I think there's also a lot of information you share on a lot of levels, on, you know, Wall Street, on drug abuse, on how you kind of got out of it. Plus, you know, I think this is a really important note that a lot of times people confuse objects and experiences, and thinking that they're sort of, that the objects might be better, but it turns out experiences are probably better. So your 100%. Experience of seeing your daughter 5 days a week is better than having the object of the 3,000 square foot apartment, which is nowhere in your life now at all.
Right.
Like, that's just gone. And you can't even look back on it fondly because it has all these bad memories mixed up with it. So what's next? Would you ever work on Wall Street? Do you want to be a writer?
Wall Street's most likely off the list. Currently, I've been writing for CNBC, and they've been phenomenal. I've been focusing more on sort of culture within Wall Street. I still have a great Rolodex. I was a ghostwriter on a book. I'm in negotiations to write another book. I actually have another book, which is fiction, but it's nowhere near ready. I love film and television. I'm currently working on a screenplay. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make that jump. I love being creative. So I don't know necessarily where I'm exactly headed, and that's a good thing. I feel like I'm in this period.
So it's a good thing because you don't feel anxious about hitting some goal, or you can just explore everything.
Well, like, let's say you were a farmer, right? And you knew, you said to me, Turney, you know, I've got a great batch of seeds, right? And you were just excited to plant these seeds, right? You weren't worrying about which ones were going to grow and bear fruit. And I feel like I'm in this period of my life where I'm planting good seeds, but I'm not worried about which ones are gonna grow.
That's a great attitude. So Turney, I just want to mention, I read the book. I loved it. The writing style is great. The stories are great.
Thank you.
I got paranoid while reading the book on your behalf. So the book's called The Buy Side, A Wall Street Trader's Tale of Spectacular Excess. And I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you.
It's been so much fun. So good luck.
Yeah, thank you. And hopefully I'll see you soon.
Yeah.
All right.
For more from James, check out The James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.